Good afternoon, everybody, and if you are in Thailand, good morning. And thank you for joining us to the Localization Fireside Chat today. My name is Robin Ayoub. You probably know me already. I don't need to introduce myself, but here you go. And today we are introducing a new conversation to the Localization Fireside Chat. We're recording, by the way, episode 106. So 106 episode talking to various executives and various leaders in the localization industry. That's exciting. And today we have an exciting conversation ahead of us. Today, we'll be talking to Andrew Smart. Andrew is located in Bangkok in Thailand. And Andrew is the founder, co-founder, of Slater. At the same time, Andrew is a strategic partner and advisor for a company called Acudocs. We can't wait to get to know you and get to know the companies that you work with, Andrew. Thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hopefully, it's not too early for you in Thailand. And thanks for taking the 7 a.m. call. I really appreciate it. I'll return the favor if you want to wake me up someday at 7 o'clock for a conversation.
I'll take you up on that. And thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you again. It was fantastic speaking with you at Gala and World Speak just a month ago. And again, thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of this conversation.
Absolutely, Andrew. And Andrew, you know, everybody knows Slater, and you know, Slater is like sort of a name. It's well recognized in the industry, et cetera. Before we get to Slater, which I think we'll focus a little bit on in a conversation on Slater a little bit, tell us your journey. And as we say on this channel, everybody's got a story. Some of them, you might surprise you if you listen to some of our chats with some of the executives that we've hosted here. Some of them, like my story, by accidents, took the wrong flight, ended up, you know, entering an industry I didn't know existed. That was 23 years ago. So what led you to Slater? And media, localization, how did you come about that? How did this whole idea fermented and came to fruition?
It's a long story, so I'll try and keep it short. But I mean, I think it all begins with where we all start, where we were born. I was born and raised in Hawaii. I was fortunate enough to be born in a beautiful setting that was also a multicultural society with a lot of different cultures all blending together. And so unknowingly, I was exposed to this very interesting world of cultures where, you know, I grew up with kids who were Korean, Japanese, Portuguese. And so when I was 7 years old, my parents took us to Mexico, and that was our first overseas experience. And I remember going through the pyramids and looking at this fascinating culture and having it inspire and just give me the travel bug at a very young age. So when it came time to thinking about what I wanted to do and study, I wanted to study international business and see the world. Studied international business and found my way out to Singapore in 1993 to work in the stock market and learn a lot about business in Asia. And it was a wonderful experience working as an analyst and then an equity dealer. And then the Asian financial crisis happened. So that required me to retool my skills. And there was an opportunity to get involved in a startup in the web design business. And that's when I started looking at business in a completely different way in terms of how people want to consume things, how it becomes not a push marketing society, but a pull marketing society. And I learned a lot from these really brilliant digital marketing guys in London about cool Britannia design and other things. And then we sold the business and I got involved in business media. So I guess, you know, as it relates to getting involved in Slater, I just tried to use my skills as an analyst to understand business. At the time, I was a publisher at Thomson Reuters, handling a community of lawyers, Asian legal business. And Florian was our client. He was running CLS. For which was acquired by Lionbridge, where you were. And so he wanted to break into the legal market, and we were publishing magazines in China, and I was hosting events and awards in Beijing and Tokyo and Seoul and KL and in Singapore. We had this great legal community. And so we did this innovative deal. We did this innovative deal where CLS would translate a third of our magazine in China. They would then be able to take our magazine because it would be given credit for that. And anytime they'd go to a law firm in China and basically be able to say, we can do this for you. They would say, well, how, can you really translate Chinese? And we say, well, look, here we're doing. So we did brand association, we did examples, and we would show, you'd be able to show clients to open doors. So seeing the business model that I was using, he suggested we look at the language industry and look at a model for news and research and these events. And so the idea was born, and the idea was born for Slater. So it's really a skipping through of a number of different life experiences that somehow bring you to a discussion. And then you have to decide whether or not you want to jump in and try to start a business. And I just want to say, very early in that cycle, Lionbridge was very helpful as one of our first customers. And we ended up, you know, paying those first few bills by doing roundtables for Lionbridge across Asia. So we will always be grateful to Lionbridge for their early support, as well with a number of other companies who saw the idea and came on board to support us.
Absolutely. And for the audience, I know Andrew mentioned the name of Florian Fay. Florian has been a guest on this channel before. I've interviewed him early on when we started the podcast. Florian and I worked together, as Andrew was saying, we worked together in the same company back in the days of CLS. Great guy. I interviewed him on the podcast here as a Slater executive. And he told also his side of the how Slater came about, etc. So pretty interesting insights. We dug into like the industry directions at the time. That's a two-year-old conversation. I think it's about time to bring him back in and give us his situational awareness on where we are from an industry perspective.
Now, well, the industry has certainly changed quite a lot. So we'll have a lot to cover. When you think about where we were at in probably 2015 compared to where we are today, and the technological changes that have happened, it's really been a fascinating industry. It's really been a fascinating ride.
So from your perspective, and I know, I don't know how much are you involved in the day-to-day operation of Slater. I'm a consumer of Slater information. Like, you know, I look for the emails every morning in my inbox, and it's pretty informative. It keeps me aware of what's going on. I consider it my radar, if you will. And I know, like you mentioned one time when I saw you face to face in Montreal, you said, you know, that's the excuse you need to call somebody. And now I think that's coming from your investment background, right? Am I correct on that one?
You are correct. So early in my career, I was a stock market analyst, and I used to have to be at those 7 a.m. meetings with the dealers trying to update them on information that was coming out. And give them ideas to trade on based on what we knew about specific companies. And then when I moved on to the dealing desk, we would find that the competitive advantage would be your in-house research, because you don't actually own the product you're selling. And so you need an excuse to call people up, and that's the research. So you try and think about who your customers are, what their needs are, what they've been doing, and you're looking for an excuse to pick up the phone and give them a call and talk to them about the issues. Now, in the institutional equity business, they're really going to turn around and give you a trade on that. But as you build up those relationships over time, they'll turn around and then they'll give you the deals that they're working on, and they'll put the deals through you. So that became a very good example of news you could use. And it was actually also early exposure to what would be considered an intranet. UBS Securities had this wonderful system. If I could talk long enough, like I'm talking to you, and pull up the research and look on it on a second screen, I could actually talk to them far more intelligently than I could do with my own memory, my own brain. And so the idea is to, you know, tell them about this, think, oh yeah, you know, with this company, that trend, margin expansion, blah, blah, blah. And they think, you know, wow, this guy knows what he's talking about. Really, you're being fueled by the research. So as it relates to any sort of business media and what's going on in the industry, you want to think about what's the type of topical news you can use, information and research that will help people do their job. And that can be anything from internal discussions, like you're having with your boss on strategy and feedback on the marketplace. Or if you're a sales director and you're trying to give ideas to your sales team, or just monitor the competition. So the idea of just having a service that looks at the industry, aggregates information, that's an excellent first step to providing people with value, saving them time, giving them information they can use, and then they can start to deploy in different situations in different ways for them to go out and do their business, to generate new sales, to manage their expectations, to work on their strategy, to improve their operations. So, you know, we just wanted to build something out that would have these different tools, these different types of information, and to do it at different price points. The other thing that I think is interesting is that we used a freemium model. So to build an audience when no one knows you, you have to give a lot of information and value away for free. And so having a free newsletter where you're providing this and growing that newsletter is a very useful technique that, you know, I think any business can do, but it's particularly useful in business media. And then from there, you try and find the 5% or the 10% that are willing to pay for something. And then you start to bring them to a room through events. Then you start to get them involved in buying your research reports. And then you start to grow that business by selling them a subscription model. Now, technological innovations come along the way, like Stripe, that all of a sudden start to turn you into an e-commerce business. So it's all about using the tools and the techniques to give people what they want and figure out how can they use it. And then that's basically your commercial model.
And I can't be, you know, thanks for that. I appreciate the explanation. It's quite logical to see where you are right now, you know, versus the journey that you just explained. It's very logical place to be in, I guess, for you having been through that journey. But when, you know, one wouldn't, you know, like some of our audience probably listening to this and they're thinking, okay, I get you. I understand that we, you know, the value, I understand how it helps from a, information helps from a various angles, as you mentioned earlier. Could you explain to the audience who are confused about the three different research firms that exist in this industry and what gap does perhaps later fill that the other two research companies, I guess, don't or do little of, or maybe don't do at all? And I'm talking about CSA Research and NIMSY in this case.
Yeah, no, I understand. You know, we're fortunate that we're in an industry where so much is happening that there seems to be enough business to go around for everyone. And there's a lot of opportunities to grow and serve clients in a variety of ways. So, you know, you have to give a lot of respect to CSA for being around for 25 years. You know, having that strong Forrester model, having built up great relationships with CEOs, and having large data sets. So, you know, as one of the first, as the first major research firm in the industry, they have a long history of serving the largest firms, including Lionbridge and others. You know, I believe Renato was one of the founders or was involved early on in CSA.
Early on, yeah.
And so he, you know, he obviously went off and started NIMSY. My impression of NIMSY is they have a lot of people with, you know, some operational experience, and they've also been able to go out there and get some big wins, like the European Commission research project that they did last year, and they're doing again this year. So you know, they've also picked up Multilingual Magazine as a content marketing arm, We would probably say that, you know, Slater might have worked in the reverse of that, in the sense of, as a startup, when you're bootstrapping it and, you know, you're getting your first income, you know, we're probably starting on the more news side of the business with news and information. So I think we provide highly timely, fast information that is useful that people can use. So we're monitoring, you know, results, we're monitoring activities and changes, we're looking at research and we're commenting on it. So I think we brought that to the industry and really developed it. We also democratized a lot of things for small and medium-sized LSPs who didn't really have a voice. We introduced products that weren't seen elsewhere, like, you know, press releases within a business media vertical. And so the ability to get an announcement out and have that for small and medium-sized LSPs and start to get that ranked in Google and be seen with a high authority site. These are important things where people are using it in business development. People start to look at companies and say, hey, who is this company? And, you know, all that's appearing is their website and not anything in the broader market and in terms of any external coverage. So I would say we provided visibility for a lot of people in innovative ways. And we also brought in with something that was very important to me, was the Thomson Reuters editorial model, the separation of church and state. So So you have to maintain a certain editorial policy and standard and integrity, and you have to separate that from anything you do commercially. And so, you know, you want to serve your advertisers, you want to get their messages out, you want to help them build their businesses through lead generation. But at the same time, the most important tenet is, you know, for all of these businesses, by the way, is, you know, the purity of the thought process, the information you're giving, you know, what's the value you're delivering, in what kind of situation. So I would say that, you know, CSA was probably, and still very early on, the larger projects. NIMSY's come in. And then, you know, as we work through our own journey, going from the news model to the events model, to the research model, to the advisory model, you know, we've moved more and more into that space of being an advisory firm and getting involved in M&A and things like that.
And I know, Andrew, that beside the media part, I know Slater does the face-to-face conferencing or virtual conferencing in certain scenarios. You've got two series, I think. You've got the virtual series and you've got the Face Later Con and a face-to-face series, physical conferences. So how is that going? I know you went through some, like everybody else, I guess, during the COVID time. It's been, you know, a bit challenging for everybody, but I'm assuming now you're back to normal. How is that going?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I love the events business. The events business is where you actually get to talk to somebody like we're doing right now in a room. You know, it's not email, it's not a phone call, it's face-to-face. You have the ability to read the situation, to get into depth. And I think it's the highest value-added point in the whole business process. So as I mentioned very early on, one way to do that is through roundtables, which we did with Lionbridge. It's a bit harder to do because, you know, getting people in different rooms and being in a physical location on a small scale, unless you have that sort of presence and you're nearby, it's tough to do globally. So then what do you start to do? You start to look at conferences. And, you know, so again, with Fairfax in the enterprise IT space, with Thomson Reuters in the legal space, hosting conferences and awards, you know, these are well tried and true business models of getting people into a room. And they often provide great neutral ground for different people who are competitors even to speak to each other as well as much as doing business development. So we did our first SlaterCon in London back in, I think, 2017. And, you know, we had people like Spence Green from Lilt and others speak there. And, you know, we just tried to get people in a room and I think it was very well received. We had to build that up. And we started to find the balance of, you know, one in the US, one in London. We started to get these anchors around these months. And then, of course, you know, COVID hit. And I got to tell you, it was, you know, for a small company, a great concern. You know, we were making some good money off the events. And all of a sudden, you know, there's this big slice of our business that's been frozen out. And thankfully, again, technology comes along to save the day. You know, there was a platform that we could use and we had to try and re-engineer it to the online model. And so we came up with SlaterCon Remote. And, you know, it was interesting because I don't know if this is a great parallel, but much like bringing machine translation into the language industry, and you're looking at this ton of technology and you're looking at the rates and the things you can charge and, you know, what's the value proposition? And it's not quite the same. And, you know, online events, are people going to pay money to actually come and listen to these speakers? Are we going to be able to package it and things like that? The wonderful thing is it was well received. It became, you know, something that I think is very different than what any other research firm in the marketplace offers. And it's still there today. And then, you know, with the end of COVID, became the return of in-person events. So we're doing both. Slater's doing both. And again, I think, you know, that's just an important part of the business. It's a big, significant contributor revenue at this point.
Yeah. And you know, just speaking personally from your side, how involved are you on a day-to-day side with Slater? Do you get involved in the running of the company or does that like handled by Florian and his team? Is there coordination? How does that work?
At this point, I've moved on in the sense that, you know, I'm happy to share that my shares in Slater are for sale. I think it's been going to a certain level now where it's at a stage where I think A larger or an institutional investor can come in and take the business to a higher level. There's certain levels where you build a business to, and they've got all four legs of the business running well. So they've been constructed, they're working well, the team's working well. And I think at this point in time, you know, there are investors out there who have built businesses in the language industry and sold them for tens of millions of dollars. I just attended an event by Flippa.com last night. They call it the Exit. They have a whole range of services of people looking to buy and sell businesses online. You know, there's institutional investors of different sizes. And so I think, you know, if you're looking at an opportunity and, you know, you find this space interesting, then let me know. I mean, it's a chance to get involved and look at the type of material. So it's a unique business model. It's a well-structured business model. And I think also it can fit into different types of portfolios. So I'm going to start exploring that a lot.
Yeah. And for the audience, you know, it's a pretty interesting point that Andrew is making here. And hopefully it's a breaking news to some of the audience that never really had the chance to talk to Andrew about this before. And it's on the channel, at least on the channel here, is the first time it comes across the wire here that Andrew is selling his shares in Slater's. If any of our audience is interested in having this discussion, I will include Andrew's contact information on in the podcast content that we produce later, the YouTube videos and the audio piece, and we'll put it on the blog site as well. Feel free to reach out to Andrew and have that discussion. I'm very impressed with SlaterCon. I trust you and Florian to build something, especially when you bring that legacy, traditional way media is supposed to run. You know, you've got the Thomson Reuters background, and how can you go wrong with that? And, you know, I mean, I've met many people from Thomson Reuters. Thomson Reuters back in the days used to be my account, and I used to sell to them quite a bit, so I'm familiar with them. And in fact, the CEO of our company, Linebridge John, he comes from Thomson Reuters as well.
Absolutely. I tell you, he's an impressive guy.
And you've hit the nail on the head. So there must be an opportunity here for somebody who's seeking investment in this media company. And there's only an upside. I mean, who knows? You're working in one industry. You may want to expand. If somebody invested in it, expand it to other industries. If the model worked for one industry, I'm assuming it should work for other industries as well. So,
absolutely.
All right. So the next story, Andrew, go ahead. What do you want to say something?
No. I was just going to say you're absolutely right in the sense, you know, my background as an analyst is applying, you know, knowledge and tools and experience into different industries, right? And so, you know, if somebody would have told me at the beginning of my career that I'd be an enterprise IT publisher for an Australian newspaper company, I would have thought you're crazy. And then, you know, turning that into, you know, Thomson Reuters, which was making most of its money off of, you know, financial data, right? And a great company. But they had this business in Asia, and this legal business. I would have thought, okay, that's interesting. What do I know about the law? You know, but you start to break it down and you start to use these experiences and you start to realize there's a buyer and a seller and these two communities. And then you start to think about the publishing and the processing and the topics. And so I don't know if it's coming through, but I kind of geek out a little bit about this stuff. I find it fascinating. I would say the commonality through all of this thread from the first conversation to now, it interests me in terms of the way people do business different ways in the same industry in different markets, you know, and how it works and the nuances and the cultural differences. And so I would just say that this is the thing that has always fascinated me about the language industry. I mean, of all the industries I've worked in, of all the different things I've looked at, it's the most interesting one because it has the most high level intellectual brain, cultural nuance, subtleties, et cetera, context. And yet somehow they're trying to put it all into a machine and make it all work and, you know, have AI tell you everything that is supposed to be happening in a million different languages. And so just the technological challenges that some of these brilliant people are working through and the people that you talk to and the stories that you hear. So from my aspect, I always enjoyed sort of setting the stage, putting the stage, giving the stage to smart people who have something to share, something to experience. You know, it goes back in the stock market days. What's happening? It goes into the business media days. What's happening? and, you know, trying to put into the hands of some really smart people. And so when you look at the language industry and you look at the change, I mean, if we could, we should probably just spend a moment here to talk about what has happened in the language industry in the last 8 to 10 years. When I came in, you know, I didn't even know the industry existed until we started talking about it. And then learning about it and then seeing, you know, just the different companies that have introduced so many new technologies. And, you know, now Marco Trombetti talking about singularity coming this decade, and where we're at. And then the productization of some of these things, you know, from DeepL using a user generated model to generate money to finance their tools. And now that they're going and the money that they've raised. So it's really a fascinating industry where some of the earliest aspects of AI have come to the fore. So in many ways, I think us in the industry, we've had a chance to be in the front row seats. So when you look at all this hype going on now, this sort of dot-com boom hype that everyone's talking about, and all the noise that's happening out there in the marketplace, well, the reality is our industry has already been on the front row cutting their teeth on making things work, you know, with machine translation for several years. And it's been a fascinating experience just to be an observer of this and just to hear the stories of people and try to share those stories. And then also just try to help them get their voice out and try to get their messages out.
Absolutely. And a lot of times, you know, when you go work for a specific industry, let's say you go work in a pharmaceutical industry or you work in a manufacturing industry, etc., you get a deep knowledge within the same industry and you get like really entrenched in that particular industry. What I found, you know, to your point, what I found really interesting in the translation and language industry is that you touch many industries and all the industries. It's like a horizontal service that goes across, you know, several other industries, all industries in general.
Yes.
And it gives you that education, if you want to call it knowledge, exposure, to what's going on around you. And you get really intimate, if you want to, in any one of those topics without actually becoming a researcher in a pharmaceutical company, right? You can still do, you know, drug monograms and, you know, healthcare filing and all that stuff without really being part of the pharmaceutical company, right? So, and you do it in many languages. That's another, you know, somebody says, well, I want to do this. Well, one thing to write it in English, but the other side of it is to put it into like 5-10 other languages. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. I mean, when most people think about business and they think about, you know, enterprise IT, it's a horizontal thing that goes across every industry. Or they think about finance and the CFO, and of course there's functions across, or marketing, right? You know, I think the big surprise about the language industry, it's this incredible industry that most of the world never even thinks about, doesn't even know it's there, but it's so pervasive in everything. And then from just an analyst standpoint, when you start to think about how it's applied in each industry in different ways and the requirements and all these sort of aspects, it becomes a never-ending, fascinating learning experience where things are just evolving in each segment every day, every week, every year. Now, what I think it makes, again, back to your question about the differences between the research houses, you know, looking at that, you know, as a stock market analyst, I start to think, well, what's different here? And that's why we started doing our coverage in industry verticals. So we broke it into 10 main industry verticals to kind of break it down to come up with this market forecast. We also tried to think about things from the addressable market standpoint as opposed to the whole pie, you know, with all the other things that are happening out there. And even when you look at the addressable market, you see that the major players, they only cover a portion of the market, which just shows you how much market potential there is out there in our industry. And the last thing I'd say is, you know, by looking at that multilingual aspect is why we coined, you know, I came up with the Language Service Provider Index. It was thinking like the Morgan Stanley Index, where you look at different countries, different industries. How do you break this up and slice and dice it? So I would say that one of the things that I think we've done is look at the industry from that industry perspective, the language industry from that individual industry perspective. And I think that's been mirrored. We also look at companies like TransPerfect, who have these different divisions, Lionbridge, who has their different divisions, and they specialize. They look at the specific needs of your clients in different industries and then serve them, you know, and then, you know, each one of those is a business within a business.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, Andrew, thanks. You know, I'm really enjoying this conversation. I can go on like for an hour and a half with you, but I really, you know, it's very refreshing to be talking shop with you. And, you know, here's what technology is helping us to do. You're in a different continent. I'm in North America. We're engaged in this conversation. You know, it's fascinating. Yes. Question for you. And I couldn't help but thinking, like, I read your bio. I read what you're doing. I read what you've done before. I just want to ask this question on a personal level. Some people like would be really interested to know, how did you cross the chasm between working for a large institution, working with a large company like such as Thomson Reuters, to become such a successful entrepreneur, starting companies, taking on the risk of moving, you know, from an idea to something commercialized? What drove you to that? You know, how did that come about? For some people who have been employees all their life, they're probably looking at it thinking, that's crazy.
Black swan events and global disruptions will have great impacts on all of our lives. So if I could say what I would mean, you know, me coming out with an MBA in finance and investments, working in the stock market and being on the institutional dealing desk at UBS Securities, dealing with the largest financial investors in the world, that was the dream job. That was the playing in the English Premier League of finance for me. And I thought, this is great. And then, of course, the Asian financial crisis came and blew up our entire industry. And
that's,
I'd say, about
swan.
60%. That was the black swan, the Asian currency crisis in 97. And all of a sudden, you know, literally, you know, the financial industry is ruthless, man. They run the numbers fast and everyone's out the door in a month or 6 weeks, you know. And all of a sudden, you know, you're thinking, ah, man, I was right where I wanted to be in life. This is who I am. This is what I'm about. What am I going to do now? And you think, well, can I go back to the US and get in the game? Can I go someplace else and stay in the game? And you start to shift and you run those courses. But interesting enough, at the same time, a friend of mine who was a fellow research analyst, he put some punting money into a British web design firm. And so with my analyst hat on, I realized, well, this was an infant industry. And this is a new use of technology. And I had just used it on the dealing desk in an intranet to pull up information and use it. So all of a sudden I was thinking, well, I can see how people would use information to do things. So I thought, well, the internet's the place to be. And they were like, can you go and help us open up our first office overseas? And I would say the big mind shift for me was I went from talking about other people's businesses and whether or not it's worth putting your money in, but not really knowing if anyone put any money, how much money they did, when they bought, when they sold, whether they made any money or not, and just commenting on, you know, whether it's a good business or not, actually all of a sudden jumping into the hot seat, being the first guy on the ground in New York City and saying, you know, can I make this work? Do even people know what the services are that I'm trying to sell? Do I even understand the web industry and what web development is? You know, I'm not a technology guy. I'm not a creative guy. And, you know, it was infant industry stuff, much like we're going through right now, these shocking changes, if you will, these exciting times in with AI. And so you have to just think, actually, the lesson I learned is people do the same thing. It's just using the tools in different ways. And it actually creates opportunity. So I found that working for a small company to be incredibly enjoyable. You have, as a young guy back then in my 30s, it became an opportunity to take on a lot more responsibility that more so than a large company would give me. I got a chance to be the first guy on the ground. I got a chance to be the managing director. I got a chance to build a team. I got a chance to go out there and sell. I got a chance to have P&L responsibility. And then I took that and I went up and went to Singapore office. So I would have to say that I've worked in both large and small companies. They both have their pluses and minuses. But I think when you start to think about entrepreneurship and the freedom of movement and the control over your schedule, it's really one of those situations. I would say from either being an equity dealer to being an entrepreneur, you get out what you put in. And if you believe in it and you can persevere through it, you can succeed. So I guess the message that I would give to the audience, if I were to say anything, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, the roles of translators or the roles of the different people doing different things. Things will change. Black swan events will happen. And you could find yourself in radically different positions than you thought you would be in. But you have skills, you have capabilities, you have network, And you can reapply all of this to create new opportunities, new situations, and take your life in an entirely new direction. And it's scary and it's terrifying. And getting on that plane and going to New York City and not knowing if I was going to make it or not. And like, you know, is it going to work out? You know, what happens if it doesn't work out? But you just have to go for it, really. You have to have a tolerance for risk, you know, to try and make something happen. So that was the transition, Black Swan event into needs-based employment, into turning that into an entrepreneurial business model, and then starting to reapply that elsewhere.
Very inspiring. And which leads me to the next question. Now that you're involved with another venture, another adventure, I should say, AcuDocs, and you're, it's a company out of Australia, I believe. And you're involved with them. You're a partner, I believe, and you're a strategic advisor.
Yes.
So glad for you. Happy, I guess. The trend continues with the entrepreneurship. That's who you are, and that's what you're doing, which is excellent. I wish everybody can do this, and make the jump basically in 2 feet, jump in and do something. Now, we talk about AcuDocs for the audience. If you don't mind explaining to the audience, what is AcuDocs and what attracted you to it?
Well, I think, you know, the most important thing in business is solving people's problems, whatever that may be. People have a need to get something done. So AcuDocs was founded by a freelance translator, Dylan Hartman, who saw a need, because when he returned from Thailand to Australia and started getting, you know, when you're in Australia and you become a NATI certified translation, you go into a directory. And so people start to contact you for business through the directory. And started getting hit with all of these inbound requests for personal document certification. So it's probably more unique to the Australian market, where you go through certain regulatory processes and you need to certify personal documents. And, you know, to be honest, it's one of those things that nobody seems to really want to do, because they're small dollar value. They take the same amount of time and energy as larger projects, you know, in terms of the process, the sales process. And there's so many other things that make the exercise unprofitable, like just receiving information, putting a quote, actually executing the work, who's going to get paid, do you prepare invoices, you know, assembling the documents. And so what he's done,
notarizing it, et cetera, right?
Correct. So what he's done is basically built a platform that automates all that process down to about 4 steps. And so you know, it automates the quotes. It gets the payment up front on the back of a credit card, which means by the time you turn around to a translator, you have the information, you have the pricing. It gets routed, much like Boostlingo finds an interpreter or Uber finds you a car driver. Perfect. It goes to a qualified pool of translators who see this bid up. They pop on it. They click, you know, they take the job. If there's any discussion about clarification, there's in-app secure conversations that, you know, our channel partners, these language service providers or other agencies can see. And then once it's ultimately approved, the client can see it online. So you don't have to like risk giving the information and not getting paid, because you've already been paid in advance. And then when it's delivered, Stripe and the financial system does all the pricing, all the splits, all the invoice, all the document assembly, all the certification stamps, and then you release it. And so when you think about all of that time to do this work being completely automated, and then paying out everybody. So if you're a translator and within 24, 48 hours, you're receiving your cut into your bank account, into your Stripe account. I mean, instead of having to send an invoice to an LSP, wait 3 months, get paid, you know, maybe one day chasing people, it just takes it to the end. So I guess when I saw AcuDocs, and I mean, look, I just want to say that first of all, the language industry is full of really incredible ideas. And at SlaterCon Zurich in October, we wanted to try and get a few people speaking on stage. There's so many brilliant people doing so many brilliant things. But what I guess what jumped out at me was the simple usability of how easy it makes a particular journey. And then how everything is automated and the needs it solves for the end customer who has an immigration problem, needs some sort of document certified, is going through a very stressful moment.
Yes, right.
You know, in terms of like anyone who's applied to do anything overseas knows that dealing with any government, any agency, just even getting your driver's license converted, you know, it's just, it's like, you know, so, you know, making that go away, like, first of all, who do you go to get a quote for? You start like searching on the internet and like da da da.
So yellow pages.
If you go, yeah, exactly. So, and then you have to start sending out emails and it's like, here's my personal documents. Can you kind of tell me like, you know, and how many people do I have to send that to? And what's your price? And what's your price? Make that all go away.
And, so, and it's just, from my understanding, it's business to consumer. And we don't talk a lot about business to consumer on this channel. That's the first time. We always talk about business to business application. It sounds like
Sorry to interrupt. Let me correct that. It's actually much more business to business. It's a channel model, much more like Boostlingo. So, so really there's a couple of different use cases that take it to scale. The first one is if you're a marketplace. So we're currently onboarding the migration marketplace
to provide. So you can white label it to other companies, is that what I'm hearing?
Well, it's essentially is a white label solution. So if you're a language service provider and you have this full suite of services and part of it includes translation and maybe even document translation. Just the fact that you have a button, instead of saying, you know, request a quote and then having them fill out a form, you're actually going straight through to a backend that is, you know, is just automating the solution right there. It says, what language do you want? What document? Upload your document. Here's your quote. Make a payment. So you're just compressing the whole discussion down into an action that enables them to act straight away. So it really supports an aspect of the business that frees language service providers. First of all, if you weren't involved in personal document translations because it was just too difficult, now this makes a whole platform. So this helps high-powered translators who are solopreneurs. This helps language service providers who are agencies who want to focus on the big ticket, high value customers, and also
everybody wants to focus on the high paying customers, and you know that what they call the tail accounts becomes a headache. So a solution like this maybe solves it.
Yes, and then of course, you know, language service providers may also have customers like law firms that are specializing in immigration, or in Australia migration agencies, and so you know they're providing this whole range of services sometimes over years in the U.S. for immigration. And, you know, this becomes, in a sense, a translation as a feature within their business model that allows them to do what they do. And then, okay, if you have to translate, if you, you know, you need some translation done on this aspect, well, let's just, you know, make it go away, you know, make that problem go away. Let's not have that hold up the whole process. Let's not have that be, you know, friction that aggravates and slows down the execution of what they're trying to achieve. So removing friction. So when you think about it, business solving problems, I need help. I need something translated. I want to help you, but it's a pain in the butt. You know, and then what does the technology do? It takes care of everything. So for me, also on a personal basis, I would say having been so involved in content, getting into more technological driven model, a platform driven model, this was the exciting thing. You know, there's been some learning curve for me personally on that. But I have to give credit to Dylan Hartman for you know being a person in the industry, recognizing the problems, and actually providing a solution that economically empowering. So think about this for a second. If you're a translator, and you know, do you really want to deal with all this back end office admin?
There's a lot of minutiae around this particular small transaction that you have to figure out, right?
Yes. Well, and just assembling it. Or if you're a project manager in LSP, do you really want to like, okay, I got to do this because my boss is telling me to do this. But, you know, now I have to assemble this document over and over again. And so if you actually take it into then you're dealing with a government agency and you're saying, hey, man, we got these forms, anything that's templatable now, anything that's templatable. So the future opportunities of this. So AcuDocs going into the U.S., which is a massive market, 2.9 million legal visas a year. So just the legal immigration market, which has become a lot more valuable because of how important it is to go through the process and be able to get there. So you need trusted advisors to take the process. 2.9 million plus 15% of the citizens were born outside the U.S. And that's just the U.S. And then we were just in Canada. Canada is a whole nother dynamic market. It was fascinating. I really enjoyed World Speak. I enjoyed talking to people about that whole new market we hadn't even really thought about. And it's been pulled. And now we have customers in Canada as well. Canada is part of the Commonwealth. Australia, Canada, UK is the next stop. Once we have this platform, it's not a lot of criteria adjustment to then say UK, EU. And so really the build out of this global platform, it becomes like a snowball. And if you look at, again, Boostlingo as an example, you know, you start to build these channel partners, they start to put their flow. All of a sudden, it becomes like a vast reservoir, a revenue reservoir, if you will. How many different sources of revenue can I come filling in this platform to then lift and grow? So we draw inspiration from companies like that that have gone before us in terms of their growth model. Now, we're at an early stage, but I mean, that's what makes it exciting for me. Getting involved at this early, early stage, seeing what Dylan's done, the investment, what it's doing, and the traction it's made. So just so many positive aspects to it. Sorry if I'm going a bit too long. I want to apologize.
No,
I'm sorry
if I'm going on too long. This is all interesting, Andrew. Don't worry.
But I mean, if you think about it, if you're a translator in Australia and you're NATI certified, and now all of a sudden, you know, you can actually be exposed to work in the U.S. without even just by being on a platform and clicking on it and getting
you're
paid.
Part of the network.
Yeah, and then that you know that goes global. Or if you're in the U.S. and you know you're looking at this market. Or eventually, you know, I mean, you're going to be have market specific requirements, say for Canada as you do, or different provinces in Canada as you do. So you're going to have to take all of these things into account. But that's the localization, the hyper localization of these
aspects. That's where you need your local resources to fulfill that, right?
Correct. And that's why one size fits all AI solution that just says, oh, isn't translation going to replace everything? Well, not really. I mean,
no, I don't see that happening on a visa document.
Well, not only do you have the regulatory aspects, but then you start to get into, you know, I'm a property company, I'm an insurance company. So the future beyond translation in terms of, you know, I want to have multilingual forms, you know, in my bank, in my insurance company. So this is just the beginning of a very interesting multi-stage journey geographically and also by industry.
Absolutely. So, you know what? This is exciting. Like I'm listening to you and I'm getting excited just listening to the story. They're lucky to have you. I know you're that's not your first rodeo. You've done this before in terms of commercializing ideas. And I look at this conversation and I feel the vibe that's coming from you. You're excited about it. And for somebody to be passionate and excited about an idea, it must be worthwhile taking a look at it. So I encourage the audience, if you don't know Acudocs, please look them up. We'll put the link on the screen. We'll put the logo on the screen. Find them out. Have a conversation with Andrew and his team and try to get to know this particular technology in our industry, in the localization industry. And as Andrew mentioned, it solves a business problem. It solves a business problem to the entrepreneur who's running a language company. It solves a business problem for somebody who wants to start something on their own and they want a platform, they don't know where to start. This is a good starting point for a platform for those freelancers or those individuals who are being, and I hear all the time, people being let go from company because, you know, AI is taking over and I have to go start my own business as a language provider. This is a way to get you started. So have a conversation with Andrew. Andrew, also you mentioned when we started this conversation that you probably going to show us what Acudocs is. I can't wait to see it. Can we get a demo from this?
Well, I won't take up too much time because, you know, the death of attention is probably, you know, product demos. I would just say that, you know, if you want to check out and get more information, go to acudocs.com. It's very self-explanatory. If you want to actually have a chat, you know, you can, you know, request a demo. I would say that, you know, if you're a language service provider or you're a translator, you know, here's just a landing page where, you know, you can have multilingual websites. This is what I was talking about. Instead of request a quote, you can basically add a button. If you're a translator, you can actually start to tap into our shared vendor pool and offer 65 languages. So let's say you specialize in Italian. Well, you can also be a solopreneur, or you could be an LSP and have 65, 66 different languages. Once you start to go through that, you click on the terms, you pick up something like, with Spanish. Everyone loves Spanish, right? And then, you decide which market you're in, like the US.
Yep.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Am I sharing?
No, you're not sharing. I don't know. I thought you were sharing.
I thought I was sharing. That's going to have to be a re-edit, I think. I don't know. So let me begin again. I'll begin here. And I'm sorry. I'll take you through it.
Okay.
So one moment, please.
I can see it now, Andrew. We can see it now.
See, this is what I was telling you, the dangers of demo. I'm not a product demo guy.
Don't worry about it.
I just wanted to say very simply again, if you want more information, go to hackydocs.com. It'll explain everything. And if you want a demo, request a demo. When you are a solopreneur or a translator or a language service provider, you know, you can have your offering. You can say what you do. You can have your pricing. These are Australian pricing because this is an Australian LSP. You know, you click on it and it takes you through to a back end. And it's as simple as that. Instead of acting to request a quote, you basically say, you know, you're directing. You give your link, your dedicated link to your customer. And, you know, they start to go through and they start to select this. And, you know, you register and you go through a process and you start to tell them, you know, I just want to translate something. And, you know, let's see if I can upload something really quick here. Let me just do my US passport because, you know, it'll be simple. Since it's my information, I don't want to put anybody's secret information out there onto the internet. And we'll see. And then you go like that. And then it says, okay, full translation, finish checkout. And there you go. The customer is there. Now, again, this is Australian pricing. The thing about Acudocs is if you're a language service provider, you set the rates and you set the payouts to the translator. So these pricings can be whatever is your pricing in your market. And it's fully flexible. If you're a language service provider and you are a or a translator, you can tap into the extended language extended pool and and start, and basically you can offer more languages than you would normally be able to do. So now you're expanding your revenue opportunity. And then the last thing is you're eliminating 80, 90%, 95% of the time and the overheads associated with this task.
Project management, basically, right?
Correct. And so you're freeing up your project managers. So you can actually move into this market without any IT investment, without hiring anybody at all, without committing to any cost beyond your own web page and your own marketing. And you can now open up and
execute this business. And Andrew, I'm assuming this business. Is it subscription-based?
That's the brilliant. $0 to register, no monthly subscriptions. Acudocs, as you can see.
I'm glad I asked the question.
Yeah, actually, Acudocs does a small service fee on top.
Okay, so transactional fee, right?
Yes, correct. So it's a usage-based system, pay as you go.
There you go.
We charge $2.90 per ticket, no matter the size, and 12.5% on the dollar value. So when you think about the margins and how much time you save and how much that costs you save, and you think about you're giving back just 12% to a platform that makes it all go away, you're coming out way ahead. You are coming.
I mean,
out
if you want to build
ahead.
Your own platform, it costs you more than 12%, I'm assuming. I mean,
correct.
Building a platform is not cheap.
So we've actually had conversations with different companies who have tried to tackle this problem. And so it's like most platforms. Do you really want to recreate the wheel? Do you really want to try and maintain that system? And for some companies, the answer is yes. The company is, I'm going to want to be able to own and control and apply it. And, you know, there are large companies like Transperfect that have massive development teams, and they're really good at doing that kind of things, and they do it at scale for different industries, and it's all in-house, and they make a lot of money off that. There's nothing wrong with that. And so it really comes to each language service provider. But if you're an individual, If you are a, you know, $5 million, $15, $20 million, LSP, do you want to deal with this? If you're a migration agency, if you're an immigration law firm, you know. Yep. So
it's small to medium business. I mean, there's 19,000 companies in the industry, and yes, this industry lives and die by the 80-20 rules. 80% of the revenue comes from the top 20 companies, and the rest of them are tail companies.
So the bottom line is, and where I'll leave it is, the scale and the possibility and the opportunity of unleashing all of this entrepreneurism across our industry is what excites me the most. And the fact that Dylan had that vision to see a problem and actually go through some very long, hard miles to get this platform to work and work well and, yep, and have all the payment solutions sorted out. There's a lot of nuance and a lot of steps in the way to make it all get compressed down. So from a usability standpoint, it's very good. And so I hope that's the interesting thing that would be the lesson for people, whether it's this technology or other technologies. It's a very exciting time in the language industry. There's a lot of people doing a lot of interesting things. Absolutely. And so, you know, I look forward to listening to your podcast as well, because, you know, you've done 100 episodes and, you know, you have a lot of interesting people on it. So I'm just very honored that you allowed me to come and speak with you.
Oh, my
today.
Goodness. The pleasure is mine. Always good to see you. I want you to say my regards to your partner at AcuDocs. I think I met him in Montreal. Was he in Montreal with you? I thought
yeah,
I
he
took
was.
A picture
Dylan
with
was
you.
There. Absolutely.
Yeah,
yes.
Dylan was
yes.
there. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So tell him I said hello. Hopefully he comes on the podcast too, if he's not too shy. And then would love to have a story as well. Not necessarily to dig into the technology. I love telling people stories in our industry. The human side is very important. So before we wrap it up, Andrew, just one final question. What is the key takeaway for those who are listening and they stayed with me for the entire hour here that you would like them to take with them after listening? What is the condensed few points that you like them to remember?
Enjoy life, because you're going to get knocked down. You think you're going to be doing something that might be great, and you know, things change, and the only thing constant in life is change. You know, but there's a world of opportunity out there, and our industry is blessed with a lot of really nice people who are doing a lot of interesting things. So, you know, build your network, get involved in LinkedIn, get involved in the industry. I mean, there's lock lunches, there's conferences, and get involved. And
absolutely,
you learn a lot. And so when you hit these pitches where you know, you have to think about what am I going to do and where am I going to get ideas, you know, and how am I going to re-engineer things? It's your network. It's your network that will the people you can talk to, the mentors you have, the people you know in the industry, they will help you find a way. They will help you. You'd be surprised at how helpful people are. So the key takeaway is, you know, just do what you like to do, be who you are, and try to enjoy it. And then, of course, you know, I hate to say this, but Malcolm Forbes gave the commencement speech at my university, and he did this 45-minute comedy routine, and then his message was, do what you like to do, because when you do it, the money will come. And I thought, I just paid 4 years of a college degree to hear that, but it was true. I hate to say it, it was true. So if you find out what you like to do, like for me, I told you, I love meeting people. I love having conversations like this. Conference businesses are great for that. Getting people into a room, going to gala, being at World Speak, having the conversations where people tell you their stories, listening and hearing their stories and finding out what they're doing. To me, again, the secret of business is solving other people's problem and being of service. Just be of service to others, help them, and the rest will sort itself out.
Thank you so much, Andrew. I really appreciate it. And I really enjoyed our conversation. And I'm sorry again to get you started at 7 a.m. in morning your time. It's I know it's a bit early.
I've been 24/7 since 1997.
You did very well, man.
I've been doing it. Yeah, I mean, well, I went off the time zone grid back in 1997 when I was starting to do this interview. So it's okay. It's good. And it's so good to connect. But I do think I need to spend a lot more time in North America. There's just so much happening there. So I'll probably be spending more time in the years ahead there. And also Europe. Europe is doing a lot of interesting things as well. So those are two major markets that I think we should look towards for a lot of innovation, a lot of interesting things, and a lot of things happening in the language industry.
And consider me one of your biggest supporter. If you ever need anything, I'm always here. If you're ever in Canada, you want to have a get together, I'm here as well. Would love to see you. And thank you so much
that.
Again for being a guest on the channel. Really appreciate it. And for our audience, I thank you so much for listening in on this particular podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, and that's your first time or you haven't subscribed yet, I encourage you to subscribe to our podcast, subscribe to our blog site, which summarizes the podcast. And I really appreciate your support. Thank you so much again for everybody. And thank you, Andrew, for joining me. I really appreciate it. Don't hang up. Stay there for a